As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm John McKenzie and I'm joined as I always am by my good friend and producer, Mike Zimmerman. Mike, how are you doing?
Good as always, John. How are you?
I'm doing very, very well, not least because we've had one of our favourite guests back on the podcast this time around. We were joined by Abhishek Raj, who is TIFO's financial expert, does a lot of the illustrated videos that are financially weighted. But he's such a good guest. He knows his subject very, very well and is just has a fantastic way of being able to set things out in a way that's understandable for me and you, Mike.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Abhishek took off his glasses and became TIFO's football finance expert, channeling his inner Superman, if you will, but really dove into the Manchester United takeover, the potential takeover, as I should say, with Jim Ratcliffe and Ineos looking to be a minority investor, getting 25% of the stake, but really owning the sporting control as well. And Abhishek really, he talked about, I guess, the benefits for the Glazers in that scenario, the benefits for Sir Jim Ratcliffe, and also the benefits for the club as well, you know, for their financial future. And as a Manchester United fan, is this actually a good outcome if this were to happen?
Yep, and we also talked about plenty of other things that I think just sort of orbit around the concept of financial fair play in the various leagues around Europe. There's so much for us to get our teeth into. And so I think the best thing for us to do is to hand over to Abhishek, who is the expert here. Well, fortunately, we're joined today by someone who can help us answer these questions, because by day, Abhishek Raj is an associate partner at Bain & Company, a management consultancy firm. But at night, he takes off his glasses and becomes TIFO's football finance expert. And it's always a pleasure to have him on this show. So Abhishek, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you, John. Thank you. And I love the reference to taking off the glasses. It just makes me sound so much cooler without them. Love it.
Absolutely. Well, today we are going to talk about lots of different topics in football finance. I think we will kick off with the big question on everyone's lips, which is about Manchester United's takeover bid. And then we will move on to talk about Juventus and their UEFA ban and what that entails. We're going to go back to Barcelona, the bête noire, I suppose, of football finance at the moment, because they're constantly interesting. We'll see where they're at and see what's going on there before moving on to talk about Chelsea's transfer spending, I guess another topic that we've often talked about on this show in this topic area. But we're going to finish things off with something slightly different. We're going to talk a little bit about a club who are much further down the pecking order at this point in time than these other big clubs. We're going to talk about Wrexham and the financial situation that they're facing as well. So Abhishek, let's begin with Manchester United, because there's been lots of speculation about this takeover bid that's been running on for months and months and months now. We've seen two main players in that bid, Sheikh Jassim from Qatar, and we've also had Sir Jim Ratcliffe, the owner of Ineos. And at the moment, it's looking as though Sheikh Jassim has pulled out and Jim Ratcliffe is in the running to actually be involved in some sort of takeover in some sort of nature. But I'll hand this over to you. Let's start off by talking a little bit about Sheikh Jassim. So Sheikh Jassim had put in a big bid for a majority share in Manchester United, right?
Yes, that's exactly right. And John, it's kind of apt that we're recording in November 2023, because actually November 2019 is when the Glazers initially said they want investment in Manchester United. And it's been 4 years. And much like everything the Glazers do, nothing's moved in 4 years, basically. Since the end of last year, they got serious about it. Obviously, they invited a bunch of bids. They landed at 2 bidders around April. When we last spoke in July, there was radio silence from the Glazers. I think that's a very big part of what frustrated Sheikh Jassim, to be totally honest. I think the way he saw it, he said, look, I'm making a very generous bid here, and I'm constantly in conversation with the owners. Why are they not telling me what they're doing? Which is, if you're evaluating the bid, just let me know, provide more transparency on the process. And secondly, if they have questions, why don't they come back to me? Basically, the communication from the Glazers was minimal. And he was quite frustrated by how slow the process was going, and basically that the Glazers were not providing the right level of clarity. The Glazers then rejected another bid. And he basically said, look, this is a take it or leave it final offer, £5 billion. Pounds for Manchester United, which, by the way, is a very generous offer. So last time, John, I remember we spoke about how to value Manchester United, and we landed at between £3 and £4 billion, whichever way you really come at it. That's actually probably gone down now, because if I look at the latest share price and market capitalization, it's actually dropped by 22% since when we last recorded the pod. So it's probably more like a £3 billion asset now, right? So the fact that he was offering five was actually a very, very generous bid. He also said he'd wipe out all the debt, he'd put money into the community. It was actually a fairly solid bid. And I actually thought the Glazers would want to wrap this up very tactfully in the summer itself, because again, Manchester United were riding high at the end of last season. The first team had done well. They'd qualified for the Champions League. They'd won a trophy. There was positivity around the football team. There was always a risk that things were going to change this season if they didn't capitalize on that. And that obviously affects the market capitalization. It affects the valuation the Glazers can get. So forget everything else. Purely financially, I thought they'd want to wrap it up in the summer, but for whatever reason, they didn't. And they rejected the £5 billion bid as well. My theory on this, and again, there's been a lot of speculation, but from what I've read and what we know of the Glazers, I feel the Glazers were actually looking at this as an opportunity to try and drive up the price. So basically, when Jim Ratcliffe came in, they thought Sheikh Jassim's potentially a very wealthy individual who would actually pay an obnoxious amount of money for Manchester United. So they thought, let's try and push him as high as possible, and they kept kind of doing that. But Sheikh Jassim's history, if you look at it, he is the head of the Qatari Investment Bank. His dad is also a very conservative banker. So he was never going to go and say, look, here's a blank check, write whatever number you want, and I'm going to pay it, right? It was never going to happen. So I think there was a little bit of misreading on the part of the Glazers, but also sensible bidding, I would say. I mean, sensible up to a point. They did offer $5 billion. From Sheikh Jassim, but he basically said this is take it or leave it. He was very frustrated with the process as well by that point. And the Glazers basically tried to push him further by rejecting the bid, and he called their bluff and said, fine, you didn't take it, so I'm going to leave it now. And I'm pulling out of the process, and now you can sell to whoever you want to. The reporting on The Athletic has been fantastic on this, and apparently the Glazers are holding out for $6.4 billion as the valuation. That was the number they had in mind for a complete sale, if that was going to go through, which is what Sheikh Jassim's bid was. Even Jim Ratcliffe's bid for 25% is for $1.3 billion for 25%, which is about $5.2 billion, right? So it's below that $6.5 billion number. Now, $6.5 billion, actually, just to put into context how ridiculous that number is, the Chelsea sale, which we spoke about last time, was at a revenue multiple of 5x, which is also the highest for any Premier League club before that. This would be a revenue multiple close to 10x, right? 6.5, because Manchester United's revenue in the most recent year was 650 million. So they're looking at a 10x revenue multiple. But also what's interesting is, again, as reported on The Athletic, one of their investor documents actually says they expect to cross $1 billion in revenue by financial year 27. That's what the Glazers have said, that their outlook is that. So my theory there is the Glazers probably thought there is much untapped commercial potential here. So why should we sell for $5 billion when we can hold out for $6.5 billion? And I think a lot of that comes from being able to monetize the global fan base. I don't think Manchester United have done enough of that. Maybe that's what they were going for. But still, $1 billion by financial year 27 looks very ambitious, because we're in financial year 24 right now. And the outlook for this year is between $650 million and $680 million. million. So it would be a substantial growth. And especially if the team keeps performing the way they are, they won't be in Europe or they certainly won't be in the Champions League, which would affect broadcasting, match day income significantly, and commercial income as well. So by all accounts, that's a very, very high number and doesn't feel very realistic. But that's what the Glazers were holding out for, which is why they rejected the bid. Now, apparently, they're willing to accept Jim Ratcliffe's bid, I think, because otherwise they've realized that they're just not going to get the investment. So it's a little bit of a reality check as well. But even there, we don't know if that will actually go through yet, right, John? Because that's still been tabled now for approval by the board. And by the board, of course, I mean the Glazers, because they own 96% of the voting rights or something ridiculous like that. So they have to pass this agreement to sell 25% of the club to Jim Ratcliffe. And we don't know if that's going to happen. I'm pretty sure even Jim Ratcliffe doesn't know actually whether that's going to happen, when that's going to happen. Only the Glazers will have the answer to that question. But purely tactfully, financially, it would have probably been smarter to get it done after the summer, because looking at the football team now, the valuation looks even more ridiculous.
So there's lots of things to tease out here. I think that one of them is the concept of valuation. And you've talked about in the last episode about how you might go around trying to value a football club. You've suggested that Manchester United are valuing the club at north of 6 billion. And Sheikh Jassim, obviously, his limit was 5 billion. Do you think that kind of discrepancy in valuation suggests that maybe the Glazers weren't entirely serious about selling the club on? And I guess if you read the context in that way, then accepting a 25% offer from Jim Ratcliffe, which means that the Glazers retain that majority ownership, do you think that suggests that actually the Glazers were never really that serious about ceding complete control of the club in the first place?
Yeah, no, I think that's a very, very pertinent question, John. And my hypothesis on this is when they started the process, they probably did want to actually cede control if they got the right price. But I think what they've realized in this year is after it had been flat, I think for about around 5 years or so, Manchester United's commercial revenue had been flat. And this year, it's actually gone up significantly. And I think what that has led to the Glazers thinking is, look, if we can actually build faith around the performance of the football team, we can potentially actually extract more juice from the asset, which I don't think they thought was possible towards the end of the last season. So maybe they're saying, look, even if we don't invest in Old Trafford and we don't ramp up the match day income, there's potentially more we can get commercially. So why don't we hold out for a slightly higher price? Or it could have been, as I said, that they thought that Sheikh Jassim would just bump up the price as he'd done, right? He'd already increased his bid twice, right? So they just thought, yeah, of course, he's going to say this is take it or leave it. Let's just reject it and hope for the best and see how he reacts to it. And he said, I meant it, right, when I said take it or leave it. But by all accounts, John, it is a very, very high expectation. But then if they're putting in an investor document that they see the potential to do 1 billion plus revenue in financial year 27, it shows they clearly see there's more untapped potential there, and that's probably why they wanted to hold out.
I suppose there's almost a vicious cyclicality to this, right? Because if they are going to pitch the value of the club on the basis of future development of the club, then they have to put money in for the future development of the club in order for that valuation to be reached, right? And I suppose this is
exactly
the big frustration that Manchester United fans have with the Glazers, is that it's all well and good saying this is what the club could be, but they're not willing to push the club to being what it could be, and they're wanting to sort of get the value benefit ahead of time almost.
Exactly. No, that's a very good articulation, John. I mean, if they were to put in the kind of investment needed to, say, revamp Old Trafford, that would commit them to another sort of 10, 15 years to see the return on that investment. I think what they're looking for is, look, if there is a minority investor who comes in and puts in a sizable amount of money, let's say, into Old Trafford infrastructure. And in fact, interestingly, right before we started podding, John, Sky News has actually broken that Jim Ratcliffe's also promised, I think, something close to £250 million into Old Trafford development, along with his 25% bid. So maybe that's what they're thinking, that someone else can kind of come in and finance that. We see benefits for the next two or three seasons as well by the time that investor kind of ramps up their stake, and then ultimately we sell out for a higher valuation. I suspect there is a little bit of that, which is trying to have your cake and eat it too. And we know with the Glazers, it's all motivated by financial, they want to maximize what they can extract from the asset.
Let's talk a little bit then about what Sir Jim Ratcliffe is offering. We've been talking about it in terms of a 25% stake in the club. That would be a minority investment. Talk us through what the idea of a minority investment
Yes.
looks like and what it is that Jim Ratcliffe is actually proposing overall.
So a minority investment, John, putting it very simply, is basically any investor or shareholder who owns less than 50%. 50% being sort of the level at which you can kind of control what strategic direction an asset takes, right? So and very simply put, if I was to get everybody to vote, would you have 50% of the voting power? And the reason why voting also matters along with shares is because Manchester United actually have two kinds of shares, right? So they have Class A shares, which are basically, I think they have about 54 million or so of Class A shares. And then they have Class B shares, which are actually 10 times the value on voting, right? So each Class B share has 10 times the voting power of a Class A share. And the reason that's significant is because most of the Class B shares are actually owned by the Glazers. So when we're saying Jim Ratcliffe is going to buy 25% of Manchester United, which shares he's actually buying becomes an important question, right? Because his voting control, he would, I presume, have wanted it to be closer to 50%. I don't think it will be. And the reason for that is, again, so if you look at how this process has evolved, Jim Ratcliffe's original bid reportedly was actually for 50% voting control. So he wanted to buy Class B shares and enough Class B shares to get him 50% voting control. But what ended up happening was the Class A shareholders, right, were looking across at their colleagues having Class B shares and saying, listen, if you are going to get a 5.2 billion valuation, right, when the market capitalization of the asset is whatever, 2.4 billion, you're actually getting a sizable premium. That's almost that's more than 100%, right? That's actually 120% premium on the share price. And I, as a Class A shareholder, think that's unfair, right? So they were about to go into uproar. They created quite an issue about it. And Jim Ratcliffe went back and said, okay, I'll buy a combination of Class A and Class B shares. That combined will add to give me 25% ownership in the club. What that means in terms of voting rights, unfortunately, we don't know, because the exact nature of what he's buying hasn't been revealed. But my guess would be that the Glazers would still have majority voting control, because the most important thing here is the Glazers do not want to give up control of Manchester United as a media and entertainment asset, right? So the commercial side of Manchester United is what interests the Glazers the most. That's where they get the maximum juice. That's what they have no interest in releasing or relinquishing. The football side of things haven't ever really interested them that much. And Jim Ratcliffe is actually interested in that, right? That's what he's apparently, again, as part of his 25% bid, requested for. So people would wonder, why would someone pay that kind of valuation, 1.3 billion or 5.2 billion valuation for just a 25% stake? What does that actually enable you to do? The simple fact of the matter is that gives Jim Ratcliffe control on footballing aspects of the club. That's what he's asked for. So what does that mean? It means basically the manager, the decision on the manager, decisions on player recruitment, decisions on the entire footballing organization structure, which has been quite poor at Manchester United for many years now. So now apparently Richard Arnold's position could be in some jeopardy. He could make changes in the rest of the hierarchy. John Murtagh's role has come into question, right? So there are quite a few changes to the footballing structure that he wants to make. That's where he's going to start. But what I would also say is Jim Ratcliffe, historically, if you look at all of his investments, he's not ever really stayed at a minority investment anywhere, right? So if he's serious about Manchester United, eventually he will ramp up his stake and actually buy the whole thing out. The question is, what is that path and what is that journey looking like? And frankly, even the 25%, will that actually go through? Will that actually happen, right? So what gives me a fair degree of confidence that he will have footballing control is nobody pays that kind of premium on the share price unless they are promised something in terms of control on the asset, right? So the Glazers wouldn't have got the kind of premium they've got from Jim Ratcliffe unless they had actually given something up. And I think the simplest thing and the thing they're least interested in, which they would have given up, is the footballing control.
So if I'm getting this correct, it sounds as though both parties would be happy because the Glazers are still able to benefit from the profits that Manchester United would make. But Jim Ratcliffe would be able to control the football club. He would still be able to play at being a, you know, a football club owner in that respect. That sounds to me, and I don't want to speak for Manchester United fans here, but that sounds to me like quite a good outcome for the fans as well.
Yeah, in theory, it does, John. But I think where this will start to go, I suspect a little south is, look, let's say Jim Ratcliffe's mission is successful. Let's say he comes in, he revamps the footballing structure. The football team is playing some of the best football we've ever seen, right? Let's say Manchester United get back to the top of multiple leagues, right? They're doing well in Europe, whatever. In that situation, where do you actually see the reward of your investment as Jim Ratcliffe, right? You see it, of course, in the fact that fans will show up massively to the stadium. But financially, where do you see the reward? You see the reward primarily, actually, the delta will actually come primarily commercially, right? Because Manchester United, if they were to, let's say, I mean, Manchester United made £650 million in revenue without actually playing that well last season, right? They won the Carabao Cup, yes, but they finished third. They didn't play European football, right? So if they were to become a footballing giant, right? Like Manchester City, for contrast, will probably earn between 700 and 750 million pounds in the last year after winning a treble, right? So if Manchester United were actually to win trophies and become a good football team, the earning potential, especially commercially, would be massive because the fan base is massive, right? And I think that's where it will start to go south because Jim Ratcliffe will say, look, I've done all the hard work on rebuilding the football team and getting the footballing decisions right, not for the Glazers to walk away with the spoils, right? Which is basically the commercial revenue. So that, which is why, again, I feel it's not a steady state sort of stable structure. Manchester United ultimately will go through more of an ownership transition going forward as well, because any investor would say, I want to see some of the return on the investment I'm making.
All of this talk of Manchester United becoming successful again is starting to make me sweat. So it might be a good time for us to move on to our next topic of conversation, which is about Juventus, who were recently banned by UEFA from UEFA competitions. And this all came down, it transpires, to FFP, as it always so often does. But I think that's where the simplicity ends, right, Abhishek? Because it's very, yeah, very complicated situation, right?
It's a very messed up situation. And in fact, before we'll talk about it in detail, John, but and I'll try to keep it simple in terms of the explanation so that people can kind of follow what's happened. But interesting stat before we jump into it. When I was researching this, and I was shocked by this stat, actually. So if you ignore the two Todd Boehly seasons, which is the last two seasons, the club that's actually spent the most in transfer fees between 2016-17 and 2021-22 is actually Juventus in Europe, right? So they've actually spent more in transfer fees, or at least reported the highest gross transfer spending of any club in Europe, which actually shocked me because and probably shocked UEFA as well, which is why they started looking into it. So what did Juventus do? I think so Juventus were found guilty by UEFA of violating FFP in two ways. And there are two kind of popular names for these scandals, right, in Italy, which we can use to kind of talk through this. So the first is what they call the Plus Valenza scandal, right, which is Plus Valenza literally translates to capital gains, which basically means Juventus overinflated the transfer fees of players that they were selling so that they could record a higher profit, basically, and that would enable them to buy more players. So we spoke at length last time, John, about how Chelsea are using amortization using it through increasing the length of player contracts. Juventus have found another way to take advantage of player accounting norms, which is basically the art of valuing the transfer fee at which you sell a player, right? And I'll talk about what I mean by this using an example, right? The most popular example, which I think illustrates this best, is actually the swap deal Juventus did with Barcelona for Artur Melo and Miralem Pjanic. So this was in the summer of 2020. Basically, Barcelona needed money, or they needed to show a profit. Juventus also needed to show a profit. But they said, let's not structure this as a simple transaction. So in actual fact, what happened? In actual fact, they swapped the two players. Artur Melo went from Barcelona to Juventus. Miralem Pjanic went the other way. And the fee that was paid was 12 million euros, right? So basically Juventus paid Barcelona a net 12 million euros, right? But how did this actually play out, right? And let's talk about why this came under such scrutiny. The transfer fee on paper that Barcelona charged for Artur Melo was 72 million euros, And the transfer fee that Barcelona paid for Miralem Pjanic was 60 million euros. So they actually chose to structure it as two separate transactions. Now, this could have been a very simple swap deal. We pay you 12 million euros and give you Pjanic. You give us Artur and we're done, right? But they didn't do that because they wanted to play around with FFP, right? Now, what is this? How does this actually help you play with FFP? Well, if I look at Juventus now, the net outflow for Juventus of cash was 12 million euros on this transaction, right? As we just discussed. But how did it play out from an accounting perspective? They bought Artur Melo for 72 million on a 6-year contract. It was 5+1, so 6-year contract, which amortizes to about 12 million pounds in that year. Yeah, they sold Miralem Pjanic for 60 million euros plus 5 million in bonuses, actually. So 65 million euros. And Miralem Pjanic, interestingly, was in the final year of his contract. We also spoke about this briefly, John, last time, which is as you keep amortizing player value, when they get to the final year of their contract, they have very low book value, right? So let's say in this case, Juventus paid 32 million euros when they signed Miralem Pjanic. They signed him on a 6-year contract, I think. So it was about 5 million euros or so left when he was in the final year of his contract. So for a guy in the final year of his contract, why are Barcelona paying 60 million euros is basically the question UEFA should have asked, which is what they asked, and they kind of probed into it. But because that's how the deal was structured, Juventus were actually able to record an almost 60 million euro profit on the deal, right? Because the 5 million bonuses canceled out with the 5 million book value and they were left with 60 million, right? So effectively, Juventus spent 12, as I said, on Artur Melo, and they sold Miralem Pjanic for 60. So they could book a 48 million euro profit, right? When in actual fact, they spent 12 million euros. So the cash balance was minus 12, right? And the profit in FFP calculations was plus 48. Yeah, so that's the first thing Juventus did, which is they artificially inflated transfer fees on both sides. So obviously, clubs are not stupid, right? Barcelona wouldn't have been okay with this unless, they wouldn't have been okay with paying 60 million unless they knew they were selling their player for a higher fee, right? So they inflated transfer fees on both sides. They did this with youth players as well. Why is it significant with youth players? We spoke about it in the context of Chelsea last time. Youth player sales are pure profit, right? So if you inflate the transfer fee of a youth player, let's also remember youth players are not very easy to value, right? Because the way to value a player, there are so many different approaches you could use. For popular players, it's a little bit more better covered. For youth players, nobody really knows what they're worth, right? They could go for any transfer fee. Any transfer fee is justifiable in that sense. So this is the first thing they did. Now, they were initially found guilty by the Italian Football Federation and docked 15 points. But they appealed and that case was thrown out. And the reason it was thrown out is because the prosecution didn't actually build the case very strategically, right? So they quoted sources like Transfermarkt, for example, for transfer fees of players. And that's not a good way to prove that a club has artificially inflated transfer fees, right? So so Juventus got away with it because of basically shoddy prosecution work. But UEFA looked into it as well. This drew UEFA's attention to this among many other transactions. And they basically said Juventus are systematically doing this. They're increasing the value of players that they are selling so that they can book higher profits and use it to navigate FFP. Yeah, that's the first violation, which is plus Valenza. The second violation is what we call the Prisma case, which again is an Italian name for it. But basically, this is where they underreported wage and salary spending on players. So what does that mean? Basically, Andrea Agnelli, Fabio Paratici, of course, who was at Spurs as well, and a bunch of senior executives at Juventus at the time, went to 3 or 4 fairly senior Juventus players, and they said, look, we can't afford to pay your wages, right? At least we can't afford to show your wages on the books. So let's do this. Let's publicly announce that we won't pay you wages for the next 3 or 4 months because we're trying to manage down expenses and navigate FFP, but we'll keep paying you the wages under the table on the side. Right. But it's just that we don't have to report it. So as ridiculous as this sounds, that's exactly what happened. And because of that, Juventus denies this, of course, because Juventus say that the payments made to them were for bonuses or something else like that. But really, this is what happened. They basically said that we'll pay you on the side, but we'll publicly announce that we're not paying you. And we'll also not report it in the financials. So this is another thing they did to navigate FFP. UEFA found them guilty on both counts. The Italian Football Federation found them guilty on Prisma, right? As I said, plus Valenza was thrown out because of shoddy prosecution, but they did find them guilty on Prisma and they docked them 10 points, actually, in Serie A last season. So Juventus finished second, but actually dropped to 7th after the 10-point docking, and they were supposed to play in the Conference League this year. UEFA's ban basically says that they have to pay £17.5 million and miss 1 year of UEFA competition, right? So if I was Juventus, I was looking at it and saying, look, they could appeal this, right, and get into a complex legal battle. They've already spent a lot on litigation in the last 3 or 4 years. Or you could just say, look, it's the Conference League. It doesn't really matter from an income perspective that much. It's not like we're playing in the Champions League. This is probably a good year to just take the ban and take the fine and then just move on, right? And that's what Juventus have chosen to do, is my read of the situation. So I tried there to explain it in simple terms. John, I don't know how it came across, but that's basically what happened.
No, that was absolutely fantastic. And yeah, you explained it very well. I understood it, so I'm sure everyone else will. But what's so fascinating about all of this stuff is that we're talking about FFP here, and I want us to move on to talk about a few other FFP domains as we go forward in this episode. But at the end of the day, the majority, and Spain is slightly different, we're going to talk about Spain next, but the majority of FFP legal domains are working in a retrospective context, right? So
yes.
If the rules are broken, then you know we impose these fines or these point deductions, etc.
Yes.
But the FFP is usually like profit and loss bottom lines in order to determine whether or not FFP is being adhered to. And I think we've seen it happening a lot now, is that you're always going to find these clubs who are going to try and find ways of being able to manipulate that profit and loss bottom line. Because if you can do that, then you can overcome maybe some of your FFP problems. So Derby County is a great example of that. The way that they were amortizing wasn't using the straight line principles that most accountants Correct. Would use when they're amortizing an asset like a player contract. They were actually front loading it, so saying a player's worth more at the beginning of their contract than at the end, and that allowed them to manipulate the profit and loss line. So this is the reality, right, of FFP analysis, is that there are going to be clubs out there who have very smart people working for them, looking for those loopholes in order to be able to manipulate their bottom line, in order to be able to spend more money than maybe they would be allowed to if those FFP protocols weren't in place.
Absolutely. Absolutely, John. And I think you summarized that really well. And because it's retrospective, it actually also gives the clubs time. So it's almost like some clubs are thinking, and we'll talk about Chelsea in a bit. Some clubs are thinking, look, let's just do the spending now and we'll figure out a way to manage it from an accounting perspective later, right? Because mm-hmm. retrospective accounting allows you to do that. You can move things, you can reallocate things, you can rebucket things, right? You can come up with innovative ways to mask what you've done. Or you can just come up with an agreement that you have with UEFA, for example, to say, look, 3 or 4 years, give us 3 or 4 years, we'll sort this out, like we'll pay you a fine, right? Whatever it is. And you can kind of say sorry later, right? So the approach of a lot of football clubs has been, look, let's just do what we have to do and we can say sorry later. And we'll talk about La Liga next, but La Liga obviously is very different in that context.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Let's jump to Chelsea first, because I think Chelsea follows on quite nicely from Juventus in terms of the fact that they've gone big and in the transfer window again. There's lots of people asking how on earth can they keep spending all of this money without violating FFP. But there's some interesting, I guess, transactions that have gone on there as well. I'm thinking particularly of the purchase of someone like Cole Palmer, with Lewis Hall going to Newcastle the other way. And again, that's exactly similar to what we're seeing with when we're talking about Juventus, right? Which is bringing in a player is cheaper than selling a player. So if you can sell a player and book the profit immediately, then you can afford to buy a player in the short term, amortize their value over a long period, and that will mean that you're booking less of a loss than you might have done otherwise.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And in fact, on Chelsea, John, I would say so two things about Chelsea, right? Firstly, just to capture the quantum of transfer spending, right, that Chelsea have done. So if you look at the record transfer spend by a Premier League club in a single season, right, which is over two windows, that was £328 million by Manchester City. I think it was in the 17-18 season or so, right? Todd Boehly's been at Chelsea for three transfer windows, which is 1.5 seasons. He's broken that record twice. just to summarize, last season, over the two windows, they spent £540 million. And this summer, again, they've spent £334 million. Right, which is absolutely outrageous at the face of it. Right, so how are they able to get away with it? I think, by the way, I think it remains to be seen whether they will get away with it. Right, because again, it's retrospective. The other thing to note, which is significant, is UEFA have actually changed their FFP norms this year. Right, and they've done and we'll talk about that. They've done a complete reset as a result. So every club goes back to zero. UEFA used to have a 3-year reporting period. That's actually gone to zero now. So you can almost start from this season. But if and Chelsea obviously are not in Europe this season, so they don't have to worry about UEFA FFP, which is way more stringent actually than the Premier League FFP. Mm-hmm. But next season, if they do qualify, they will have to worry about it. But I think two things that have helped Chelsea navigate it, I don't know if they will be successful, but two things that they're using to try and navigate it, which is very, very clear. One is, as you very rightly said, John, youth player sales, right? So youth player trading is something Chelsea have used for years to navigate FFP. And it's something that, frankly, is also a strength of Chelsea, right? The youth academy is very strong. They've produced many high-quality talents that have gone for good money, right? So Mason Mount to Manchester United for £55 million is just £55 million pure profit. Lewis Hall, as you rightly said. But then there are many others, right? Fikayo Tomori, Mark Gahey, last season, Tammy Abraham, Ruben Loftus-Cheek. There's so many examples of youth players who they've made decent money on, which they can book as basically pure profit in year itself, right? So that's the first lever. The second thing Chelsea have been using is, and I know people talk about the amortization quite a bit, but this summer, the second thing that they've done is they've actually offloaded a lot of players on very high wages and actually not for very high transfer fees, right? And this actually takes me to a bit of a pet peeve football finance topic, which I actually wrote a T4 video on recently, which is that wages matter more than transfer fees, right? And Chelsea have used this quite cleverly. So let's take a few examples, right? This summer, if I think about the players that Chelsea released, and I'm adding up certain players with very, very high wages, right? So Cesar Azpilicueta, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, Kalidou Koulibaly, N'Golo Kante, and Edouard Mendy, right? Let's look at these five players. These five players together, and in fact, if I take out Mendy, because Mendy's wages actually were not that significant, only $3 million a year. If I look at just those four, right, which is Koulibaly, Kante, Azpilicueta, and Aubameyang, those four players alone were sold for a combined €20 million transfer fee, right? So basically three of them left for free, and Koulibaly was sold for €20 million, right? Which is not huge if you look at it, and it shouldn't have created that much maneuverability from an FFP perspective. But if I think about the wage impact of selling those four players created £50 million of wage flexibility for Chelsea. And why is that significant? If I look at Chelsea buying Moises Caicedo for £115 million, the annual cost of that for Chelsea, let's calculate that, right? £115 million on an 8.5-year contract is roughly £13.5 million per year amortization cost. That's the annual cost of the transfer fee. And Moises Caicedo earns £250,000 a week, which is roughly £13 million a year. So it's about £25-26 million each year. So they can actually afford to buy two Moises Caicedos just by offloading those four players, right? And not even for a fee, right? Those four players combined went for 20 million euros, right? So it's not like they got massive transfer fees for them. So when it was reported actually that Saudi clubs were doing Chelsea a favor, it's not because Saudi clubs were paying them massive transfer fees, right? In fact, they didn't pay them massive transfer fees. Saudi clubs did them a huge favor because they took very high wage players off their wage bill. And that created huge FFP flexibility for Chelsea because it enabled them to buy, as you said, Cole Palmer, Nicholas Jackson, Christopher Nkunku, right? So many signings in this window. So these are the two things, along with, of course, the old amortization trick. But the amortization trick of dividing a transfer fee over a very long contract won't work going forward because UEFA have actually changed the amortization rule now. They've said, look, Chelsea was smart about this, but from this season onwards, as part of the new rules, you can only amortize up to a maximum of 5 years. Yeah, so it's the contract length or 5 years, whichever is lower. So it doesn't matter. Chelsea can sign players for 15 years. They can still only amortize for 5 years. So that's actually a smart thing and a good thing from an FFP check perspective. Will Chelsea be able to navigate FFP? I think remains to be seen, John. It's an open question, but definitely offloading players on high wages and youth players going for decent fees have helped Chelsea bridge some of the gap. On the UEFA, I just want to talk a little bit about UEFA's FFP and how that's changed, right? So if you contrast it to the Premier League, why is the UEFA FFP actually considered to be more stringent, right? The Premier League FFP basically says that clubs can lose £15 million in any three-year reporting period. This is loss before tax. That can be extended to £105 million if owners provide £90 million in secured funding, right? Which Chelsea's owners have done. So basically, Chelsea can lose £105 million in any reporting period. And then there are deductions that they allow as well in this. So you don't count any spend on stadiums. You don't count any spend on the youth academy, women's teams. And there are COVID deductions as well for the COVID years. Next year, we actually come out of COVID years, right? So the COVID years were 2019-20 and 2021. So when we come out, when we do the assessment next year, there's actually 21, 22, 22, 23, 23, 24. That's the three-year period. So we're out of COVID. So COVID deductions are gone. So that's a problem. But I still think Chelsea will be able to navigate Premier League FFP because it's fairly lenient with the 105 million allowable loss. UEFA, interestingly, until last year, actually only had a 5 million euro allowable loss over a three-year reporting period, which is very, very tight, right? So as I said, the Premier League had 15 million pounds allowable loss over 3 years, which can extend to 105. UEFA only had 5 million euros allowable over 3 years, which they allowed to extend to about 30 million euros in total until last year, right? Now they've changed their norms. Why have they changed their norms? They've actually looked at what La Liga has done and they've said squad cost is actually a fairly good metric for financial sustainability. Let's look at a squad cost guideline. So what UEFA's new FFP norm basically says is the total annual spend on the squad. Now, UEFA defines the squad slightly differently than La Liga, and we'll talk about that difference. UEFA defines the squad as just the men's first team and the head coach, right? So they don't look at the reserves, they don't look at the youth academy, they don't look at the women's team, etc., right? So they just look at spending on the men's team and the head coach. The total salary, which includes wages, bonuses, everything, UEFA mandates should be not more than the total spend plus any amortization spend, right, on players that they've already bought, which is, of course, the annual charge of the transfer fee. All of that put together should not be more than 70% of turnover, right, or revenue. That's the guideline that UEFA are aiming for. Now, they know that clubs are completely messed up. So if they were to introduce this today, most clubs would not play in UEFA competition and there wouldn't be a UEFA competition. So they've basically said that there is a ramp down period where you can be at 90% this year, you can be at 80% next year, but in 3 years, you have to be at 70%, right? So that's the new UEFA guideline. And in doing so, what they've done is, look, if you do maintain that guideline, the allowable loss has actually gone up. So what was earlier 30 million euros over a three-year period is actually now 60 million euros over a three-year period, right? Again, 55 million has to be secured through owner funding. So as we said, Premier League is 15 million over 3 years, 90 million more enabled through owner funding. UEFA is 5 plus 55. And they've also said that if you are a club in good financial health, which I assume is, and they've not clarified this, but I assume it means you meet the 70% guideline on squad cost. If you're in good financial health, you can actually spend up to 90 million euros as well. right? Over so the 90 million euro losses allowed over a 3-year period. Now, the reason this is important is obviously Chelsea hope to be in the Champions League soon enough. And if they are, they will be subjected to this. And this assessment begins next year. So we'll see. We'll see where Chelsea land on this eventually, John. But hopefully that summarizes what were the two things Chelsea were doing and also why UEFA's FFP will be tougher for Chelsea to navigate than Premier League FFP.
So do you think that we'll see in the future teams actually being disbarred from European competition because they fail that squad cost limit?
So ideally we should, but I think if you look at the way UEFA has implemented FFP so far, John, I'm a little skeptical personally because Juventus is actually the first club that's actually seen a proper ban. Otherwise, they've basically just given clubs 3 to 4 years to get things sorted out. They pay an annual fine or they just pay a fairly hefty fine and they move on, right? Because they sanctioned about 20 clubs, I think, around August or September earlier this year before the Champions League began, to say, look, you're pretty much violating our FFP as it stands. Interestingly, Chelsea was not one of them, but obviously Chelsea are not in European competition this year. But they basically, and I think the reason that's significant is that they didn't do anything about it. There was no ban. They obviously also know this is a reset year. They're probably waiting for clubs to get used to the new guideline and start solving for it. What will they do in 3 years, I think, remains an open question. So my view is it'll probably be a combination of hefty fines, which knowing Todd Boehly, he'll probably say that's a cost of doing business. It's fine. We'll just pay the fine and move on. And maybe a ban in a very extreme case. I mean, what Juventus did was actually criminal, right? I mean, they just completely reported wrong numbers. So that, I mean, if all of that got just a 1-year ban from the Conference League, I'm a little skeptical about what they'll be able to do. But really, they should be implementing it quite seriously, because that's the only way that clubs will actually take it seriously and actually start planning better for it. But again, UEFA's is still a retrospective FFP, which is clubs can navigate it, they can reallocate, they can get clever with accounting to make it work.
Well, I think that ties us up on Chelsea, but I will say that, Abhishek, you do have a video out on the TIFO Illustrated channel talking about the issue of transfer fees versus wages. That video is titled Why Transfer Fees Aren't As Important As You Think. So if any of the listeners want to get more in-depth information on that, then head over to there. But let's move on and talk a little bit about Spain then, because as we've said, Spain is a bit of an anomaly in the FFP reality because they have a prospective rather than retrospective approach to FFP. So what that means is that you can't break the rules, because if you are over limits, then you simply aren't able to register players. So you talked about squad cost and squad cost limits. La Liga has a squad cost limit set up so that each club is given an amount that they have to abide by each window. And if they aren't hitting that limit, then the questions are whether or not they can actually register players that they've signed. So do you want to talk us through that reality a little bit first, and then we can talk about where they're at?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I think you captured it well, John. I think La Liga is the hardest FFP of the three. So if I compare La Liga to the Premier League and UEFA, it is the hardest. Also, La Liga is the only of the one of the three that does not allow for any COVID exemptions and did not as well. So they were fairly clear on the regulation and they stuck to it even through COVID. So La Liga's FFP, how it works is it's forward-looking, as you said. So at the start of every season, every La Liga club will submit a budget, right? And this will be a budgeted revenue and a budgeted kind of expense outlook for the year, right? And they're supposed to cover things like debt repayments, etc., as part of that as well. La Liga will then look into their actual financials, the most recently released actual financials, as well as the detailed budgetary statements that they've submitted, and using a combination of this will come up with what they call an allowable squad cost limit. Right now, the squad cost as defined by La Liga is slightly different than the way UEFA defines it, right? So the way La Liga does it is they take the turnover or the revenue, they take out any non-sporting expenses, so this could be commercial expenses or basically anything not related to sporting activity. They take out any debt repayments or any debt obligations that need to go in the year. And then what you have left is what they call your allowable squad cost limit. Now, this includes every single kind of squad cost, right? So it includes, obviously, pretty much similar to UEFA, the player wages and amortization. But it also includes the staff costs, right? For all of the coaching staff, not just the head coach. It includes the youth academy, the reserves, it includes the women's team, it includes everything, right? So this is a total allowable squad cost. And that number is calculated and presented to La Liga clubs at the start of the transfer window to say, this is your total squad cost. If you're over that squad cost currently, right, you need to do whatever you can in the window to A, get within that guideline. And also, if you're over, we will actually not allow you to spend as much in the transfer window as you could if you were below that number, right? So as an example, La Liga slashed Barcelona's squad cost limit recently, actually. So Barcelona's squad cost limit last year was actually close to 650 million euros or something of that sort. And they slashed it significantly this year because two things happened. One is Barcelona's one-time financial levers, which they deployed last year, which we spoke about in the last pod, have kind of run out. So that's the first change. Second, La Liga have also changed their view on these one-time levers, right? And this is significant, John, for Barcelona, because La Liga have basically said that now, if you are to sell an asset for the purposes of generating revenue, you cannot count it as part of this squad cost calculation if it accounts for more than 5% of your revenue, right? So if Barcelona sells stuff, their Barca Studios, Barca Digital, whatever, for 200, 300 million euros, that's obviously well above the 5% of revenue limit. And La Liga have basically said, we've seen what you've done, well played. And now we're changing the rules to clip some wings, basically, right? And say, you can't do that anymore, right? So we won't count that as part of your squad cost limit. So combination of all of that has meant Barcelona's squad cost limit is 270 million euros, is what La Liga have announced. By comparison, Real Madrid's is 727, to be precise, million euros, right? So it's massive. Now, what that meant was Barcelona were significantly impeded in the summer transfer window, because if you are above, if your wage and total sort of squad cost is above that number, and Barcelona well above that number, they started the summer at 570 million euro squad cost or something, they were well above it, then any player sales that you do, you can actually only use a fourth of that to buy players. So a fourth of the profit, that is, right? So let's say they sold a player for 40 million profit, right? Now that may be a transfer fee of 50 million and then you take out the amortized value, whatever it is, you end up with a profit of 40 million. You can actually only spend 10 million of that per La Liga's rules if you're over the squad cost limit. So that's the first problem, which is they clipped the wings on the spending that Barcelona could do. They didn't allow them to basically use the levers, because they said, look, levers, we won't let you use any levers that account for more than 5% of revenue. And then as a result, what's ended up happening is Barcelona have had to navigate the entire summer transfer window. I think they had a 3 million net spend, basically, right? Of I think they spent it on Oriol Romeu, but they offloaded a number of players on high wages. We spoke about this last time as well. So Jordi Alba, Gerard Piqué retired, Sergio Busquets, of course. They sold Ousmane Dembele, they sold Frank Kessier. They generated a lot of money because they were desperately trying to reduce the squad cost. Barcelona's squad cost is still 400 million or so euros. So they're still well above the 270 limit, which means their spending again in January is going to be impeded as well. So, and they can't use one-time levers this time to get away with it. So they are literally going to have to fix the fact that their players are currently earning too much. Barcelona have already deferred a bunch of payments to players. In fact, their personnel debt is 230 million euros, right? Which is a very sizable number. That's how much they owe their own players, because they've deferred salaries in the past to try and meet this guideline. So the short answer, I would say to your question, John, is La Liga FFP is very challenging for Barcelona, and the squad cost limit they've been given is still difficult to meet. And the fact that Barcelona have actually won La Liga, posted a record profit, right, in the last year. So they released their financials recently. It's a record profit. And they're still struggling to navigate La Liga FFP is a fairly worrying thing. And I think the thing that explains that is if you take out the one-time levers from their record profit, they actually made a 300 million euro operating loss last year, right? So their record profit is 423 million euros, which is what they report in their financials. But that's because of the levers. You take that out, they actually lost 300 million euro on an operating basis, day-to-day basis with the club, which is obviously, it's the worst in La Liga. So for the La Liga winners to have the worst operating loss is obviously a bad situation. So Barcelona need to fix their day-to-day running of the club. This has been an issue for a while. And one-time levers cannot bail them out every time. And in fact, now it just won't work.
So basically what it is that Barcelona have been doing is they've been trying to inflate their revenue, because if you get your revenue high and you take away all of the squad costs that we've talked about, then it means you have a much higher squad cost limit to be able to spend. So if you can artificially inflate your revenue by front-loading investment, so selling off rights for many, many years into the future, for example, is one of the things that we've seen. Then the idea then is that you can raise your squad cost limit, spend more on players, and then the idea being to be able to build a team which is good enough to generate more revenue. And so in the long run, it won't matter that you've sold off your future assets. The question, I guess, then becomes is, La Liga aren't going to allow this, it seems. So how do Barcelona survive?
Yeah, that's a very good question, John. And Barcelona, by the way, have also faced some issues with their levers, which I'll just talk about. So they were supposed to get two payments, actually, for their levers recently. They were supposed to get, I think, 30 million each from Orpheus Media and Socios, who they sold Barca Vision stake to last year. And they didn't get it because basically they deferred the payment, and La Liga kind of said, look, we need the money now, right? Like, if you want to include it in your FFP calculation. So they actually have now decided to sell stake in their media division, to a Mexican investment firm, apparently for 49% of their media division for 180 million euros or so. And that comes with a 60 million upfront payment. And the reason that's significant is that allowed them to register players this year. But as I said, since then, what La Liga have done is they've just changed the rule. So now any such lever pulling will not count at all for the revenue for FFP squad cost calculation, right? So it doesn't matter. They can do it. If it's more than 5% of revenue, it will not count. So it doesn't really help Barcelona keep doing it. And in fact, it's dangerous for them as well, because as we said last time, these are growing revenue streams that they're giving up to do that. Now, obviously, what they've done, they've already done, which they will continue to pay for, because they have to pay for the TV rights for the next 25 years. There's a fee, right? Because obviously they got the benefit last year. What do Barcelona do now? I think they have to still trim the squad, John. There's just no other way to put it. They need to take out players on high wages who are not performing. They did that this summer, actually. As I said, they sold Dembele, they sold Frank Kessier, they sold some players in the summer. I think they will need to still prune the squad. The biggest strength I think that Barcelona have, which they need to continue to harness and develop, is actually La Masia. La Masia is the biggest, it's the best, probably the best youth academy anywhere. And those players coming into the first team and performing the way they are have been a consistent feature, actually, of Barcelona. And they have a head coach who encourages that and actually like fosters that. That is the best way for Barcelona to be financially viable, in my view, because you build the squad around those players, get those players into the team, get them playing around a core group of players who you retain within the first team, and just offload the rest, right? Work with a slimmer squad cost. Youth players also, by the way, don't come on very expensive contracts initially. You can get them into the team, and then you can renew their contracts, as they've done with Gavi and Pedri, etc., in the last couple of years. And I think if they continue to see success on the pitch, if they do well in the Champions League, that's very important for Barcelona, doing well in the Champions League. It has a huge impact on income. If they do well in the Champions League, they do well in La Liga, they will make the money, right? So I don't think that they should look at this as as they've done in the past, which is, let's just buy all the best players in the world for a lot of money. And then let's see where that goes. Because like their transfer debt already, John, is 200 million euros, right? They owe a bunch to Leeds, actually. John, you know about this, for Rafinha. They owe a bunch to Leeds. They owe a bunch to a bunch of clubs, right? So, and I was telling you earlier as well on their debt, right? The total amount that they owe is not funny. They owe 230 million in player wages, which they've deferred in the past to navigate FFP, right? They didn't pay Frankie de Jong for so many months, as we know, with the whole Manchester United scandal. So there are enough debts that they need to pay off, right? And they should focus on doing that. They should not go back to this gambling approach, in my opinion, of let's just buy players to achieve instant success. Grow the players within the academy, because that's your biggest asset. get them into the first team, and you will continue to see success. Make the odd transfer. I'm not saying no, right? If they can navigate it, make the odd high-profile transfer. But a lot more clarity and a lot more effectiveness in their transfer spending is what they need, really, to see longer-term financial success.
Well, let's move on quickly. I think we do have just a little bit of time to talk about Wrexham, and I'm quite keen to talk about them because they're quite an interesting prospect. We together made a video about how long it will take Wrexham to get to the Premier League if they are to ever reach the top division of English football. I should say English and Welsh football, it being Wrexham. But yeah, a very interesting situation for them in terms of assessing a club from a financial point of view as a future prospect to rise to the highest level. So you did a lot of the research for that. What were the things that you found about Wrexham that made you think that actually reaching the Premier League could be a viable option for them?
Yeah, I really enjoyed working on this video, John. And I want to say I absolutely loved how it turned out. So like fantastic stuff on the video. I think as I read more into Wrexham, and we did a T4 on the Illustrator channel, we did a video on Wrexham as well on their financials. I think earning potential for Wrexham is massive, right? And I think that's the most important thing that I learned through the research, which is because of the global popularity of the documentary, because of the profile of the owners, they're going to get a lot of attention and a lot of love commercially. Right, so a lot of eyeballs. So broadcasting income for Wrexham is going to be significantly higher than League 2, League 1 clubs when they get to League 1. And their commercial income is also going to be very, very high. The reason why that's important is that will allow them a higher squad cost, because much like La Liga, the EFL also has a salary cost management protocol, right? Which is similar to La Liga in the sense that it is a total amount that you spend on the team. And the difference, again, is the EFL, I think, only takes player salaries. So they don't take amortization and they don't take, again, the academy and the reserves and all of that. But that number is capped at 55% for League 2 and 60% for League 1, actually, right? They made some exceptions in COVID years, but that's the number that clubs have to work with in those leagues. Which means if you generate a higher income, which Wrexham will, and it could be like an order of magnitude higher than the clubs they're up against, they would then have a much higher wage bill that they can potentially play with, right? And that allows Wrexham to actually build a much stronger team than the other teams around them. So I think it gives them a competitive edge to get promoted faster into the championship. Once you get to the championship, though, I think it's a different ballgame. And that will actually need a significant amount of investment. So I don't think it's going to cost Wrexham, at least per my research, a lot to get through League 2 and League 1. I see them, and I know in the video, John, you also called out that clubs that have gone all the way have spent the maximum amount of time in the championship. And I'm not surprised by that, actually, because that's where clubs really go for it. Like owners, the owner appetite for funding is just enormous. And in that video, we showed how much owners have kind of pumped into championship clubs in the last 10 years, because they know there's a pot of gold if you get to the Premier League. And you can kind of understand it, because Luton Town now will probably earn 170 million minimum over the next 3 years because they qualified for the Premier League, even if they get relegated this season. If they survive this season somehow, they actually get parachute payments. So that goes closer to about £300 million over 5 years. That's a huge windfall. So owners feel it's absolutely worth it. Let's pump the money into the club to get them into the Premier League. So because all your owners are doing that, I think that's the first problem. The second problem is obviously while Wrexham will get the eyeballs and they will have the commercial uplift, championship clubs now actually have decent earning potential, right? So a lot of them are able to pull in good commercial sponsors. A lot of them get decent broadcasting income. Again, because there is the promise of the pot of gold, right? At the end of it, everybody's kind of counting on it. And many championship clubs now actually have decent players, very strong coaches, right? So it's not going to be as easy for Wrexham to get out of that division. But if they find the investment and the partners, I still think Wrexham are differentially stronger as an asset, right? Commercially, as well as a brand, the pull that they have, they will be differentially stronger if they find the investment to compete in terms of the squad cost and investing into the team. My sense is it'll probably take multiple seasons. It'll probably take at the minimum, between sort of 150 to 200 million is my guess, again, estimate, and this is dollars, of how much it will cost Wrexham to get from the championship into the Premier League. The combined wealth of the Wrexham owners, right, as we saw in the video, is about 400 million or so. So they are going to need investors. They're going to spend half their net worth to get Wrexham into the Premier League. I doubt that. But I think the real question is, can Wrexham do it? I absolutely think they can. I think it's a differentiated asset for sure, because of all of the commercial appeal that the brand has generated.
So I think that brings us to the end of this episode. It's been great fun talking to you, Abhishek. But I think if there's one thing we should take away from what we've been saying is that revenue is everything when it comes to football finance. I think if you are able to generate revenue, then you are quids in. We're talking about Manchester United, a team who have played badly for over a decade now, and they still are able to generate the revenue to stay relevant in football. And then elsewhere, we're talking about these clubs. We're talking about how Chelsea can invest in players enough to get them back to the level that they wanted to be at. We've talked about how Juventus are finding ways of trying to boost their revenue, and the same with Barcelona as well. And then Wrexham, a club that are really well set up to be an elite team because they have the potential to be able to generate revenue as well. So I think that's what I've taken away from this episode. It's been absolutely fantastic, as it always is, Abhishek, when I talk to you. No doubt we'll get you on in another few months' time to talk about the next thing that's happening in football finance. If our fans want to listen to what you've got to say, you are available on Twitter at Abhi Psych Raj. So that's Abhi Psych Raj. That's on Twitter. And you have a fantastic Instagram channel as well, where you put out videos, which I recommend that people go and have a watch of. That's the_cheeky_throw. So all loads of ways for you to get hold of what Abhishek is doing. And as I say, no doubt we'll have him back on in the future. But Abhishek, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much, John. It's been fantastic and really fun as always. And I do want to say I've really enjoyed the podcast. I don't know how you and Mike, and Mike deserves a lot of credit as well for this, of finding the guests that you do. You're able to go so deep on so many interesting topics, and it's just been a treat to listen to the podcast.